From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, movies. First, a 90s take on the Western. We feature an interview with director Sam Raimi. His film, The Quick and the Dead, stars Sharon Stone as the mysterious gunslinger who rides into town and Gene Hackman as the bad man who runs the town. It just came out on video. Also, we hear from Gabriel Byrne. He's currently starring in the offbeat heist film, The Usual Suspects. He co-starred in the recent film adaptation of Little Women, which is now out on home video. And Stephen Schiff reviews the new film Beyond Rangoon, directed by John Borman, who also directed Deliverance and The Emerald Forest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Administration officials say First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton will go to the International Women's Conference next month in China. She's decided to accept an invitation to attend. A formal announcement's expected later today. U.S. officials are being quoted as saying China's release of American human rights activist Harry Wu made the difference in Mrs. Clinton's decision. New York's record-breaking drought and strong winds are making it tough for firefighters who are battling a giant blaze on Long Island's Hamptons Resort area. A Long Island Railroad train station has been damaged. It's not clear how serious the destruction is. Sean Garrett of member station WSHU reports.
Thousands of acres of pine forest and at least 10 buildings, including a train station, have already been claimed by the fire in this beach community 100 miles east of Manhattan. Governor George Pataki hopes Forest Service rangers flying tanker planes in from the west can help contain the blaze.
Just coming in 120 people to join and back up the volunteers and the state officials. So it's still dangerous, but the effort that is being brought to bear is tremendous, and we're hopeful that during the day today we can make significant progress.
Wind gusts moved the fire so quickly last night, 600 people evacuated to schools had to be moved again when smoke engulfed those buildings. For National Public Radio, I'm Sean Guerin in West Hampton, New York.
In Chicago, dozens of bodies, unclaimed by families or friends after this summer's heat wave, were buried today at a mass funeral. NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
No relatives or friends were traced for 42 victims of July's heat wave in Chicago, the one that killed more than 500, mostly elderly people. County investigators say they went to great lengths to locate relatives to attend to the burial of the victims and to take care of whatever possessions they may have left. But none were found for these 42 persons and three others who have already been buried. At the time of their deaths, investigators said that many of these people would have survived had there been someone helping them to get to a cooler place or to make sure they were drinking enough fluids. But these people mostly lived and died alone. Now they're buried together. The graveyard says it was just a simple service. A minister briefly said a few prayers. In Chicago, this is Edward Lifson.
Senator Bob Packwood has changed his mind and is now asking for public hearings into charges that he committed sexual and official misconduct. The Oregon Republican says he decided to ask for open hearings because the Ethics Committee changed its rules by investigating two more recent complaints against him. The Finance Committee chairman says he thought the record of the ethics investigation had been closed. It's not clear if Packwood still has the right to a hearing, which would allow his attorneys to cross-examine his female accusers. On Wall Street, the Dow is up more than 19 points at 4,599. Trading is quite light. This is NPR. Israeli undercover troops have killed two Islamic militants in a shootout in the West Bank. Authorities say they then bulldozed the house the militants were staying in. The raid in Hebron was part of Israel's attack against Hamas, the Palestinian group that opposes the peace process. Hamas has also claimed responsibility for two deadly bombings that have killed 12 people over the last month. Hamas has also threatened to carry out more suicide bombings to derail the peace talks. Retail chain Sears has agreed to allow disabled children and teens to participate in its fashion modeling courses. The agreement is part of a Justice Department settlement. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The settlement resolves a complaint filed by a Seminole, Florida sixth grader who has spina bifida, a defect involving the spinal column. According to the girl's mother, she was told by a Sears Model Club program instructor she couldn't participate in a fashion modeling course because the class used a runway that was 1 foot off the ground. The instructor reportedly also suggested the girl seek individual instruction because she would be out of place with the other children in the course. Assistant Attorney General Deval Patrick says by entering into this agreement, Sears is doing its part towards eliminating the attitudinal barriers faced each day by persons with disabilities. Sears has agreed to let the girl attend a free 4-session modeling course at the store of her choice. The company will pay her $3,500. The retailer has also agreed to train its instructors about the Disabilities Act's requirements. In addition, Sears will distribute a statement that says it will not discriminate against children with disabilities who want to participate in the modeling classes. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The U.S. government is warning Americans who are living in and visiting St. Petersburg, Russia. Authorities say there have been serious threats of a violent attack on Americans living in the city. The U.S. consulate says the threats indicated the attack could come within weeks. Americans there should avoid accepting gifts or packages and watch their luggage. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you enjoy movie westerns, you'd probably like The Quick and the Dead, a western with a 90s sensibility. I know I liked it. The Quick and the Dead just came out on home video. On this archive edition, we have an interview with the director, Sam Raimi, recorded last February when the film was released theatrically. In this western, the mysterious gunslinger who rides into town is a woman, played by Sharon Stone. The town is controlled by a bad man, played by Gene Hackman, who virtually owns everything and everybody in it.
I'm confused. All I hear from you spineless cowards, is how poor you are. How you can't afford my taxes, my protection. And yet somehow, you've all managed to find the money to hire a professional gunfighter to kill me. Where's all this money coming from? What am I to think? If you got so much to spare, I'm just going to have to take some more off you. Because you clearly haven't got the message. This is my town! If you live to see the dawn, it's because I allow it. I'm in charge of everything. I decide who lives or who dies.
Hackman runs an annual competition called the Quick Draw Tournament that attracts gunslingers from around the West. It's a series of showdowns in which the fastest draw wins a big pot of money, but all the losers lose their lives in the gunfights. Sharon Stone is the first woman ever to enter, and you sense her real ambition is to kill Hackman. Director Sam Raimi made his first feature film at the age of 22. It was the low-budget horror film Evil Dead, which became a cult hit that spawned two sequels. Raimi also directed Dark Man, which starred Liam Neeson. For The Quick and the Dead, Raimi talked with Sharon Stone, who also co-produced the film, about how they would change her look from glamorous seductress to toughened gunslinger.
We felt that we really had to strip her down, figuratively speaking, and remove the lipstick and the rouge and the hairdos so that it looked like she had no makeup on and just came into town as a much more plain-looking woman.
Weather-beaten.
Weather-beaten, exactly. Now, we all know that, I mean, we weren't going for an authentic look because, of course, women didn't really wear chaps and wear cowboy hats and guns on their hips and come riding into town as gunslingers. There were like one or two horribly murderous women back then who did use guns, but none of them wore this this getup that is classically worn by a man. Of course, the men didn't really do this either. It's all just a myth created by the movies.
Yeah, I love the point that you're making, you know, that all the male heroes aren't like authentic history either. So why not cast
That's
a hero
right.
as a woman? So do you see Sharon Stone's characters modeled on Clint Eastwood and Sergio Leone movies?
The movie The Quick and the Dead is definitely based on all of the work of Sergio Leone in his 1960s spaghetti westerns. And therefore, our lead character is based on his heroes, and they happen to be played by Clint Eastwood. But I don't think we were trying to model Sharon after Clint Eastwood, if that makes any sense. She was her own person with her own goal. And it's certainly a part that's been played in 1,000 Westerns, and that is the Lone Rider comes to town to kill the guy that killed their pa. But this time it's a woman. It's maybe a role that was originally created by Kurosawa in his samurai films, with their riders coming into town to clean up the bad guys.
Now, are you a big fan of Sergio Leone movies?
Yes, I am.
One of the things he's done, or he did, I should say, in his Westerns, there's this incredible fascination with close-ups. I mean, the iconic look in his films comes from the camera being really tight on really weather-beaten, often grisly faces.
That's right. He had a marvelous eye for detail, and he really made use of the widescreen cinema, and that is, of course, a much wider frame than it is tall. And most of the great Westerns were shot in that particular format, and he, as you say, would come in for a super close-up, a particular detail, a piece, a droplet of spittle of tobacco juice as it rolled down the chin of one of the town's worst outlaws. And when you watch that spittle roll across the wide screen, it's just, it's very, very dramatic.
Or somebody
it's
chewing
big.
A cigar or eating That's a right. cigar in one scene. So did you want to do anything similar with close-ups?
Well, in this movie, the feel of it was like a Sergio Leone movie, but we tried to keep the visual style away from his films. We just tried to approach each scene in The Quick and the Dead as dramatically and as differently as possible. For instance, there are about 13 or 14 showdowns or gunfights in The Quick and the Dead. That is that magical moment in Westerns where the villain and the hero square off in the sun-drenched desert street. They wait for that clock to strike, and then they slap leather like lightning. Twin six guns jump out and bark flame. And this happens so many times in the movie that we had to try and go about presenting each gunfight in a different visual style to keep it interesting for the audience.
So what are the different visual styles you used?
Well, one time for Sharon Stone's gunfight, when she entered this gunfight competition and her time came to face down the opponent, we decided to tell it as much from her point of view as possible. So that became the visual and the sonic attack on the scene. And that scene was shot with a lot of point-of-view shots, obviously, the things that she saw, and shot with a lot of close-ups of her face and how she, and we really tried to get into her head using the soundtrack, and that is when she had to listen for the click of the striking of the minute hand of the clock that designated the beginning of the gunfight when you could really draw, we tried to get into her head and screen out all the other sounds. Screen out the wind and the crowd murmur and the dust scraping across her boot until she could hear nothing but the interior of that clock. So we really tried to be very selective on the sounds and play them as she might have heard them. Certainly overdoing it a little bit, because that's what movies are. It's blowing it up out of proportion. It's not a realistic approach. But in that way, we tried to make it different.
Your most talked-about shot is in one of the gunfight scenes. And without giving too much away here, I won't say who shot or anything, but somebody is shot through the head. And you can see, like, the horizon through the hole in their head. I think it's been called the Swiss cheese shot. That's how people refer to it to me. Like, what did you think of the Swiss cheese shot is the way it's usually asked of me. At the video store, I got asked that just the other night. And I think it's a controversial shot because some people think of it as being really over the top, too cartoonish for this particular film. And other people think, wow, that really makes the movie. Tell me your impression, why you did it.
Well, there is an old... This movie, The Quick and the Dead, is telling a story of this character that rides into town, but it's a 90s take on all the Westerns we've seen before. Now, a lot of people have a problem with that because the Western is a revered story genre for Americans. When you mess with it, which I did, and I took things too far sometimes, it sometimes upsets people or unsettles them because it is supposedly the story of our beginnings. of course. The West was a bloody and horrible massacre of innocents. And it wasn't really the noble picture painted by Hollywood, but it's what we would like to believe. So when you mess with that, it's getting on touchy ground. And this movie felt, we felt that we had to update it and take a 90s sensibility. And that was to say to the audience, we're aware that these are cliches and we've seen these before, but here's a new angle on it, or here's a new pace to it. And here it is presented with a new cutting style and a filmic style of the 90s, and with a wink too, because we're aware of how silly these conventions are also.
I guess Sam Raimi, he directed the new film, The Quick and the Dead. He also directed Evil Dead and Army of Darkness and Darkman. Is this the first film where you've had to work with a lot of horses and gunplay? I mean, I know you've worked with chainsaws. but, you know, this kind of real show-off gunplay style, did you ever work with that before?
Well, I've worked once before with horses. I don't like horses.
What, an Army of Darkness?
Yeah, they don't listen to me.
All right. No respect for the director.
And they always upstage the actors, you know, shooting a kissing scene, and there'll be a horse in the background shaking its head and going, oh, boy. Just trying to upstage the actors. I'm about to call action. I say, ready, and the horse takes off because it rehearsed it a few times, and it knows it anticipates the cue, you know. And horses are good basically for, you know, Elmer's glue and burgers in the south of France, in my opinion. But I don't like them. They mess up the street.
What about gunplay?
Well, most of the pictures that I've made are monster movies, B movies, and usually that's one weapon you pull out to fight the monsters. But I don't usually make big gun movies, but Quick and the Dead is really a gun picture. It takes place in a time when the old cap and ball system of guns were going out, and this is still when they had these single action revolvers versus the double action revolvers they have now. That means you have to pull the hammer back, tick, click, and then pull the trigger, bang. You couldn't just pull the trigger like you can now. That's what we have now, these double action. But first of all, let me say I don't know a thing about guns. I'm just kind of spitballing what I learned from Thel Reed, The Fastest Gun in the West. But this was a time when they were doing conversions between the cap and ball, when guys would actually pack their bullets in the chambers of their guns, little balls of steel or lead and the gunpowder together, and they'd make their own bullets, so to speak, in the gun. And the cartridges, or the bullets, the shells that were came complete, and you could just snap into the gun. So this movie, boy, this is a long-winded answer. This movie...
Oh, you're really into it now.
This movie shows cap and ball guns, conversion guns, guns that were cap and ball and converted to a more modern-day type of gun, and a modern single-action cartridge gun where you could actually put the shell in the chamber.
But there's also the kind of gunplay where, you know, somebody has to, like, twirl it around their fingers or jump backwards onto a horse, do a somersault, and then shoot a target. You know, all that real show-offy, fancy kind of stuff. So,
absolutely.
Did all the actors have to get trained, or did you have stunt guys doing it? And did you feel that you had the eye to figure out what was a convincing gun stunt?
I didn't feel that I had the eye to figure out what was a convincing gun stunt, actually. But we were fortunate in that we called upon the services of The Fastest Gun in the West. That is Thel Reed. And he holds the quick draw championship, world's record. And that is he can pull a single action revolver out of his holster, draw and fire, hit a target with a certain amount of accuracy in the shortest amount of time. And he holds this record. And we got him to train all the actors in The Quick and the Dead on gun drawing and firing and a different style for each of the actors. For instance, Sharon Stone was taught one particular style versus Gene Hackman, who had his own cool and deadly style. You very seldom see Gene Hackman spin a gun in this movie because it's too flashy for him. He's much too powerful for that.
Right.
But for a show-off, like the part of the kid, which Leonardo DiCaprio played, he's nothing but all silver guns with a lot of flash and a lot of spinning.
My guest is Sam Raimi. He directed the film The Quick and the Dead, which just came out on video. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with film director Sam Raimi. You said something really funny in a print interview a few years ago. You said it was your ambition to make a movie that would play in a theater that you weren't afraid to go into.
That's right.
Did most That's of your right. movies play grindhouses?
Yeah, most of my pictures are B-movies, and they play, you know, schlocky houses. And I love going to them in those movie theaters, you know, and it's theaters where your feet stick to the floor with the jujubes. They're all stuck there, and half the seat is falling off, the armrest. But
you go to the bathroom at the risk of your life.
That's right. They're very dangerous houses, but that's where those B-movies play, and those are the kind of movies that I make, really. But that's you also get something when you go into those houses. You get an audience that is not afraid to scream at the screen and really get involved in this movie. They don't have any pretense about, you know, being ladies or gentlemen. They just want to interact with this movie with raw fury or abandon, and it's a great experience to be a part of that, especially if you're the filmmaker and you've had something to do with creating that entertainment.
Did you ever see one of your horror films with an audience whose reaction upset you? And what I'm thinking of, an audience who's hollering, yeah, kill him, get him, or you know, encouraging the decapitation of somebody or the rape of a woman or whatever.
The audience never reacts the way I expect them to, mm-hmm. so I'm always surprised at that. But I've never really had the audience jump on the monster's side in my B horror movies.
Really?
And not really.
Because so many times when I've seen a horror film, I've been in an audience where the enthusiasm seems to be for the monster or the killer. And sometimes that's kind of fun. Sometimes I find it very disturbing.
I've seen that in the first Freddy movie, mm-hmm. Where the audience is rooting for Freddy. So I know what you're referring to in other pictures. And I've often wanted to stand up in front of the audience and say, no, no, folks, you got it wrong. Freddy's the bad guy. I've seen that, too. But it's kind of because they've made Freddy into this pop. It's a different way to approach it. He's like this pop counterculture hero, you know. And I don't like that either. I find that very confusing and upsetting. But I've never experienced it in my movies, mainly because I don't really have a focus for the evil. It's usually this dark and unseen thing.
Right. It's a presence as opposed to a physical person.
It's harder to root for something like that, I think. Maybe that's why.
Mm-hmm. Right. Maybe that is why. No, I know a lot of directors have said that they started off making horror movies because that was the way to make a cheap film, and a cheap film that might get noticed. Now with Sundance, I think a lot of people who might have started off making horror movies make their personal coming-of-age film based on Mean Streets. that'll get shown at Sundance. Did you do horror films as a way to get noticed or because that's the genre you loved?
I had never really liked horror films when I made my first horror movie called The Evil Dead. I learned how to make them by watching them in a drive-in for a year, because I felt that was the only kind of a picture, no matter how badly we made it, we could still get to play in some movie theater or some drive-in theater. Because the movies were so bad in those drive-ins back in the late 70s, I thought, I know I can make something, you know, as good as this if I really work on it. So I made a horror movie because I felt I could finally get it seen on the big screen. And I was more concerned with the finance. I knew I'd have to raise money from investors, and I felt the only way to return that money to them would be to make a movie that actually played. So it turned out that a horror movie, for me back then, was the way in.
Did you have any hobbies or interests when you were young that the adults around you thought of as weird preoccupations?
I used to rehabilitate ants, and my parents never approved of that.
How would you do that?
I'd capture them in acorns, and if they escaped, they were punished. And if they endured their confinement for the proper amount of time, then they were released as rehabilitated citizens. They never liked that, though.
What would you do to punish them?
I can't go into it.
Oh, gee.
It was very severe.
Was this your practice to becoming a director?
No, that was the one thing I did, I think, that you know, I don't know, maybe my parents didn't approve of, or that adults didn't approve of. I quickly outgrew that, though.
Uh-huh. Did you collect comic books when you were young?
Yes, I had a great comic book collection when I was younger. I have about 3,000 comic books. They were really good training for me visually, because the comic book artist has to choose the one moment in the story or in that scene that best depicts what's happening. So he has to draw a picture, choosing that instant that best tells the story. And it was a very good training for drawing storyboards, which are shots, basically the drawn version of the shots of a movie.
Which kind of comics did you like the most?
Well, when I started reading comic books, I read Batman and Superman. They were very simple stories of good and evil. And then when I got to be about 10 or 11, I started to read the Marvel comic books, which were just great. The Stan Lee's work, where he had Spider-Man who had problems, you know. He had to fight the bad guys, but he also had a problem with his girlfriend. She didn't understand him, and his homework had to be done.
Do you think the visual style of comics affected your visual look in your films?
I think that I would take from comic books the fact that they would go for a very dramatic, graphic approach mm-hmm. in the visuals. And that's how I approach the visuals in the movies that I make. Not laid back.
Right. Okay. Now, what direction do you want to head in the future, now that you've made a more expensive film with movie stars? Where do you want to head next?
Well, I'd like to try and make a picture that uplifted the audience and left them with a real charge, a real feeling of having their spirit soar.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, it's unlike you, too.
I want to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like I'm pigeonholed. The only thing that's holding me back is either my lack of ability to do that, or, you know, it's time to do that. I really want to do that. I want to have that positive effect on the audience.
Well, tell me why you want that.
Because I really have always, I think I'm just discovering that that's what I've always wanted to do. And when I make a joke in a movie, in one of the Evil Dead movies, and the audience laughs, I love that. Then I think, well, what's really behind it, what I'd really like to do is to take it a step further, not just make them laugh, but uplift them. The feeling about themselves or their point of view on a particular story or character, and let their spirit soar if it's possible. And I know it's possible because I've felt that in movies. And I've been afraid of approaching that because I know you have to really be in touch with yourself, and you've got to really be a craft, very technically adept at how to tell a story on film and how to work with the audience. I may or may not be ready for it, I mean, as far as a craftsman, but I'm going to try and do that.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being on your show.
Sam Raimi recorded last February when his film The Quick and the Dead was released theatrically. It just came out on video. The film's score pays homage to composer Ennio Morricone. So let's hear Morricone's theme from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up from the archives, an interview with Gabriel Byrne. He's starring in the new thriller, The Usual Suspects. He played Professor Bear in the recent adaptation of Little Women, which is now out on video. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Beyond Rangoon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, The Usual Suspects, is a heist film with one of the most convoluted plots I know of. I confess I found it hard to follow the story, but I remained under the spell of the terrific acting. One of the stars is Gabriel Byrne. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded with Byrne last winter after the release of the film Little Women. It was the third movie version of Louisa May Alcott's novel about four sisters and their mother in mid-19th century New England. Byrne plays the older professor who falls in love with Jo, played by Winona Ryder. Although the professor is an Italian immigrant, Byrne himself is Irish. He started his acting career in Irish television and made his film debut in John Borman's Excalibur. He starred in the gangster film Miller's Crossing. He produced and starred in Into the West and was the executive producer of In the Name of the Father. Gabriel Byrne really wanted a part in Little Women. He told me why.
I wanted to do it because the book itself to me is an important book, and I had read it, or had it read to me when I was like 9 years old by my mother, who read the entire book to us before we went to bed at night time. So it had a very special kind of memory for me. And I also liked the idea of the character, who was a kind of shy, sensitive man, an immigrant who could barely speak English, who was poor, but who loved this woman and encouraged her, and but not in a patronizing, condescending way, but in a way that truly brought out her real self. That was interesting to me.
When your mother read you Little Women when you were young, did the story have a lot of resonance for you as a boy?
Yeah, well, you see, that was at the time before people had said that, you know, there are differences between, told me that there were differences between the way men and women view the world. And I loved these characters, and I loved the world that it evoked, because living in Ireland, the world of Concord, you know, Massachusetts, was on the one hand accessible because I understood what it's like to live in a small town like that. And on the other hand, it had a kind of a mystique about it because it was America, because it was far away, because it was another century. But I did fall in love with Beth, who, to my shock and horror, died halfway through the book. And I remember talking to a friend of mine, and it was a conversation between two eight-year-olds, and I told them that when I grew up I was going to marry somebody like Beth. How wrong I was.
Absolutely. So what other books did you read when you were young that made a big impression on you?
The first book I read was Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. And I really wanted to live at the Admiral Benbow under that creaking sign, looking out for seafaring men with one leg. That was a magical book. And at that time, for in Ireland, I think possibly because of my mother and my grandmother, I was introduced to the classics there, you know. And I read, or they read to me, Oliver Twist and, you know, most of Dickens. I mean, I had read most of Dickens by the time I was 13 or 14. And I'm trying to get my son, who's 5 now, interested in that kind of world, but I'm up against the Power Rangers and those kind of characters. So I'm having a hard job trying to do that.
I guess there wasn't nearly as much competing for your attention when you were young.
No, there wasn't. It was a different world. It was a literate world, you know. It was a world where books were important. And I see that now that books are becoming less and less important to kids.
So what was the town like where you lived?
I lived in Dublin, which is a peculiar place because it's a city, but it's also a village. And I was brought up in the countryside, and in many ways it was still the 1920s there, and it was a town where, as I said, everybody knew everybody else, where characters stood out, where there was a tremendous sense of community, and. I think one of the reasons that Little Women is kind of, that people find it an interesting movie is because it evokes that world again, the world of community and neighborliness and basic, like, Christian kindness between people, you know.
But did you want to stay with that family, or did you want to, like, get out and get to a bigger world?
I actually wanted to become a priest, which I did actually, which I studied to be a priest for 4 years, because I wanted to, looking back on it now, I think it was some kind of a romantic escape from the world, not a desire to belong to the world.
Why did you want to escape?
I really don't know. Looking back on it now, I don't know why. But I found the idea of being away from the world seductive. I still do.
Did you feel you were called?
Yeah, well, the word vocation, the translation of the word vocare is to be called, and people told me that I had a vocation to the priesthood, you know, and I kind of believed it too. But, you know, the world of the theatre and the world of the priesthood is not that very different. They're both very theatrical occupations, I think.
They both have costumes?
Costumes, ritual, ceremony. The Catholic Church especially had it figured out a very long time ago. I mean, the confessional predates Freud by 2,000 years, and and also the concept of light and sound and incense and all that thing. It's a very sensual kind of theatre, really.
Of course, there's something that's really different between, say, the seminary and the theatre. You never get out of character in the seminary. You got to stay in character all the time.
You got to be in character all the time. I wasn't too crazy about that part of it, really.
It must be, you were a young man, so what you were going through, like, puberty and training in the seminary at the same time.
Looking back on it now, the education that we received in Ireland at that time was kind of repressive. It wasn't about the leading out or the bringing out of anything from within you and fulfilling your potential. It was actually the exact opposite. It was about repressing the real part of yourself, and that's something I find I feel slightly bitter about. You know, I've just had a book published which I wrote, which came out in Ireland last week, and it's about, a lot of it is about what it was like to grow up in Ireland in the 50s. And on the one hand, we kind of cherish the myth that it was an innocent, beautiful place. Carefree. The reality is that it wasn't actually, and it was very repressive and Victorian in many ways.
We're featuring an interview recorded last winter with Gabriel Byrne. He co-starred in Little Women, which is now out on video, and he's now starring in The Usual Suspects. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor Gabriel Byrne. So when did acting start to interest you?
I didn't become an actor until I was quite old, I suppose, for this business. I was like 28 before I started. And I was a school teacher. And I was always interested in theatre and cinema, always. In fact, I'd worked as a film critic of sorts for a newspaper in Dublin. And I never thought that I could actually make a living at it or you know, have it be a full-time occupation for me. And I was doing a co-production at the school one day between the boys' school and the girls' school. I used to teach in the girls' school. And one of the kids got sick and, you know, in typical, like, Mickey Rooney fashion, there was nobody to go on except me. And I went on and somebody said to me, you know, you should think about doing this for a living. And I had been thinking about doing it for a living, and that's how I became an actor at the ancient age of 29.
Let me go back to the seminary for a moment. What got you out of the seminary?
I was expelled for smoking in the graveyard, which, you know, a friend of mine had cigarettes, and we used to go to the graveyard in the morning times after breakfast and smoke there. And we got away with it for about 4 months until one day, I remember, the priest came in and walked between the aisles, and he said, somebody's been smoking in this room. If he doesn't stand up now, etc., etc. So I stood up and I was brought to the principal's office, and he told me that basically I was no longer being called. I was actually being sent home. So they sent me home and in ignominy and disgrace. 4.5 years as a failed priest.
Did you expect to be praised for your honesty?
I did, yeah. Yeah.
How naive.
How naive. I should have just kept my mouth shut and I probably could have continued to smoke.
Well, what did that do to your faith and to your sense of yourself?
I always envied people who had blind faith, who believed without question. And I never really had that kind of faith. It's taken me a very long time to get it back again. And now I believe in a different way. Yes, it did. But then again, I kind of took the blame on myself. I thought, well, I did something bad, I did something wrong, so therefore I deserve to be punished for it, you know. It's a very old kind of predictable Catholic reaction.
So do you think they did you a favor, finally, and throwing you out of the seminary?
Maybe I did them a favor.
I had read you had also been seduced, was the word that was used in an article, seduced by somebody at the seminary, a priest maybe, or a teacher?
Not seduced, no. I wouldn't say that, but there was sort of some form of sexual abuse, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was that something that you dealt with or something that really hurt you?
It's many years ago now, and I didn't realize what was going on at the time. There was a kind of an acceptance of it among the kids there that it happened, and that there were certain people who were, were responsible for initiating it. But it was regarded as a fact of life, and there was nothing you could really do about it, and there was no big deal about it. So it happened, and. When I think back on how that was accepted, covered up, silenced, and that makes me angry. But the truth is that it didn't do me any damage that I'm aware of.
In Miller's Crossing, the Coen Brothers gangster film, you played a gangster, but I really like the way you once described the character. You described him as a man who feels everything and shows nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you gave a great performance in that film, but I'm thinking of how hard it is to show that on screen, to show feeling everything, but showing nothing.
I think that was the real challenge of the role, you know? And to me, it was the most difficult, the most complex role I've ever played. I mean, they just are brilliant writers. There are just not many screenwriters around like the Coens. And so the complexity of their writing had to be matched by the complexity of acting. But that's, if I was to aspire to anything as an actor, that's the kind of acting that I kind of really admire. I really admire understated actors, you know. People like, Spencer Tracy, people like that. People who can suggest emotions without really showing you in vivid, over-the-top detail, you know. I tend to go for more understated stuff, and it's less spectacular, but to me, more interesting in the end.
Gabriel Byrne recorded last winter after the release of Little Women, which is now out on home video. He's currently starring in the film The Usual Suspects. Byrne's memoir, Pictures in My Head, will be published next month in the U.S. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. Today we'll be hearing about the decision that Mrs. Clinton, Hillary Clinton, will be going to China to take part in the UN-sponsored Women's Conference. That, of course, following the expulsion of Harry Wu from the People's Republic of China. Also on today's program, we'll examine U.S. relations with Beijing. We'll hear about the latest on the United Nations and Iraq. Also, a story from outside New York on the brush fires on Long Island. And we'll be hearing from the first, we believe the first, father and son combination to play in the Little League World Series.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The director, John Borman, has made movies in all sorts of genres, from film noir in Point Blank to Arthurian romance in Excalibur to wartime memoir in Hope and Glory. But most often, he's been attracted to remote locations and bizarre stories. Take, for instance, The Emerald Forest and Zardoz, and even his most famous movie, Deliverance. His new film takes him to remote Burma for a political thriller. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Beyond Rangoon.
Borman has a knack for taking an exotic setting and making it seem even more so. The way his camera glides along Burma's jungle rivers in Beyond Rangoon, the way his crane shots soar over streets exploding into political violence, his technique vivifies whatever it touches. What it can't do, though, is vivify flat characters. That's been the problem in movies like The Emerald Forest and Excalibur, and it's a big problem in Beyond Rangoon. The heroine, Laura Bowman, played by Patricia Arquette, is an American doctor, though I could never get myself to believe that, even when she's ministering to the wounded. Back home, Laura's just been through an inconceivable tragedy, the murder of her husband and son, and as a result, her soul has gone dead. Her sister has cajoled her into joining up with a tour of Southeast Asia, but none of Burma's stone Buddhas or curving spires seem to touch her, and her isolation increases when she loses her passport. The rest of the group goes on to Thailand, while she's left behind in Rangoon, waiting for new papers and the next flight out. Burma, though, is in the midst of a crisis. In an extraordinary scene, Borman shows the great pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, played by Adele Lutz, entering a square full of soldiers and pacifying a tense situation by her sheer majestic presence. But the tension soon returns. A kindly tour guide named Aung Ko, played by a non-actor of the same name, takes Laura beyond Rangoon. By the next day, they're both caught in the middle of a violent political upheaval, and Laura's forced to find inner resources she didn't know she had to save Anko's life and her own. Along the way, there are a lot of conversations like this one, in which Laura tries to sort out past and present with Anko's help.
I walked in and I saw Danny's leg sticking out the door to the den, and my husband. They stole his wedding ring. I was brought up to believe that If I were good, if I worked hard, that I had a right to happiness. I was a fool, wasn't I?
We are taught that suffering is the one promise life always keeps. So that if happiness comes, we know it is a precious gift, which is ours only for a brief time.
Perhaps some people will find more profundity in that exchange than I did. And believe me, there's plenty more where that came from. To my mind, Beyond Rangoon suffers from an essential blandness that undercuts its genuinely frightening action scenes and its masterfully staged suspense scenes. Anko and his band of pro-democracy fugitives are all such uniformly smiling, bright-eyed sweethearts that they might have just stepped out of a propaganda poster. And though Patricia Arquette has been a lively and touching actress elsewhere, her attempt to portray someone who's dead inside deadens the movie. Her flat, almost disembodied voice can't pump any energy into the clumsy dialogue. And the screenwriters let her down in the film's second half, where she's supposed to be reawakening, by not giving her anything much to say. Beyond Rangoon is never less than exciting, but it's never surprising either. And it's devoid of complexity and humor, and, strangely, of politics as well. At its best, it's a pretty good movie. It's just that it should have been a great one.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Therabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock and Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Sacrifice of Isaac, a new novel from Neil Gordon. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin a week-long series of interviews about the epidemic of violence that is taking the lives of many young people in America's inner cities. We begin with Rochelle and Anthony Yates. They became activists after their 5-year-old son was caught in the crossfire of 2 drug dealers and killed. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.